Welcome to the PeopleStack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk, founder of Jen Bunk Ventures and architect of the PeopleStack. My guest for this episode is Spencer Verity. He is director of product at Speed and Function. Welcome, Spencer.
Hey, Jen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. I'm excited to talk to you. And just to give some folks a little bit of context, Spencer was a student of mine in my former life as a professor. This was lots and lots of years ago now. I've lost count. So it's always cool to reconnect with folks from my former life and former students and to see them doing so well as you are, Spence.
No, I appreciate that.
Cool. So let's start talk about Speed and Function and what you do there. What is the typical day in the life of a director of product, if there is such thing as a typical day?
Sure. So a little background. I had previously been a partner in a web development company called Omni Solutions, and Speed and Function acquired us because we had a really great front office, a lot of great client-facing operations that were going on, and Speed and Function had a much more rigorous development force, much wider base of talent, and they were doing most of our back-end stuff. So we said, hey, this is a good match. Let's just merge this together. Service industry is way too slow to grow naturally. We need, the only way to grow a service industry business usually is through mergers, acquisitions. So merged, and I went from being more of a product owner on an individual basis with some of our clients that had complex applications, and it was an interesting practice because I never dove into cognitive ergonomics or human factors as much in my graduate degree. So there was a lot more going on when it comes to user experience, interface design, making applications easy for users to use, and catering to both, you know, the 10-year-olds that can tap around an iPad faster than anyone else, and people who are really savvy with business on occasion, but not necessarily the most modern technology. So lots of different populations to cater to. That was what I was doing with most of the clients from Omni. And when we moved, when we merged, I kind of took a step up, and I work more with clients on a overall collaboration method. And I get involved in scope refinement if there's details related to certain kinds of choices they want to make in the features and different components that go into an application.
Got it. So what's the overall goal of Speed and Function? If you were to do the elevator pitch for what you do and what the company does, what is it?
Sure. We're a web application development company focusing on front-end development. What that means is we build applications that are elegantly designed and made to be appealing to users and also highly functional across different platforms. So in terms of technology choices we usually make with some of these projects, WordPress and Drupal LAMP stacks for the marketing side, and then we have single page applications that we can build with Angular or React or Ember for the front end, and of course a Node stack on the back. So it's pretty wide-ranging technologies. Most of our staff is in Ukraine and Montenegro. We have about 9 or 10 people in the States, 50 people total, 25 of those are developers. Here in the States, it's mostly business analytics folks like myself, a few consultants that we source out to different companies because we can do a staff augmentation model where we provide a developer to other companies to use, and they go pretty quick when we bring them over. So great staff, very talented, love working with them. And the project managers can usually kind of take and carry the ball after I bring a client on, so I can focus more on the higher level stuff.
That's great. It's always nice to have good project managers to work for that can actually carry the ball instead of dropping it, so that they're often a key link in the chain. So that's awesome to hear that you have a great team, lots of great folks to work with.
It's the wire brush of development. It's not always fun to do.
Awesome. So it sounds like in terms of your typical day, if there is one, it's a lot. It's very client-facing, would you say, talking with current and potential clients about what they would need in terms of the web application.
Yeah, exactly. And usually these conversations start out with very broad business analytics for like how their operations are working, how the product that we're building or assisting ties into their streams of revenue, and how it can benefit them. In most cases, these are things that they get direct cash off of, e-commerce sites, software as a service products. Mm-hmm. Other times they're internal. So there's a wide variety of ways technology can integrate with clients. And I usually end up telling a client, if you can avoid doing software development, avoid doing software development. It is a long, dangerous path. You have to be very prepared for it. So I spend a lot of time setting expectations with clients and saying, this is what you're in for. I'll work with you to make sure that we're kicking off the right way.
Got it. So you mentioned SaaS versus more internal stuff. So it sounds like what I was going to ask before you said that, but now I know I definitely want to ask it, is does Speed and Function, do you see yourselves as a SaaS company, as more of a made-to-order, create custom solutions? Like, so is there like a platform, or is it more about, okay, we can create this for you if you want, but the customized way is going to mean a lot more resources than the out-of-the-box way?
So we don't actually create any products that we ourselves sell as software.
Okay.
More or less, it's mostly custom development. Sometimes it's more support, DevOps on the side of just keeping everything up to date, bug fixing, stuff like that. But most of our ground-up builds are purely custom. Obviously, with mm-hmm. like some of the more rote, generic, typical kinds of things, like a marketing site, we'll use a content management system like WordPress or Drupal,
okay,
something to get off the ground. But if it's a full-blown application, that no matter what the end client's going to end up using it for, it's usually pretty custom. And
okay,
it's an interesting space that we're in right now, because most of the business that companies like ours used to get for like building websites, it's going out the window, because site builders, tools that are out there, very cheap options, are just illuminating as a possibility. It's really lowering the bar for the technical level needed to dive into these things. So right now there's a giant wedge in this market where it's half of the stuff can be taken care of by site builders, like Wix, Weebly, Squarespace, and then the other half are, wow, really, really deep technology that you understand intimately inside and out. And I'm really looking forward to a point in time when the number of technologies is narrowed down and generalized, kind of the same way that local operating systems have been much, much simpler now. You don't have to know assembly code to write something in C++.
Mm-hmm. And I've experienced that the choice, that having so many choices can be debilitating for my business, where it's like, okay, do I need to use Squarespace, or should I just ask my husband, who knows some development stuff, to build it for me? So my husband is a tech manager, but he started off as a software engineer. He often says to me, when I'm thinking about, you know, how do I build this, or I need this application for my business, or I need this web page for my business, he often says the same thing that you said earlier, Spence, which was essentially avoid software development if you can. That if there is yeah. if there is a solution out there that meets your needs, just use it. And even though I have a husband who knows how to do this and connections to lots of people who know how to do this stuff, I'm very often just buy the out-of-the-box stuff and pay the $30 or $40 a month or whatever it is, in some cases more than that mm-hmm. per month, because the people who build those tools are really awesome at it. And why reinvent the wheel, kind of thing. So yeah, like the Squarespace, but also like survey things like SurveyMonkey, mm-hmm. that kind of thing, or like for doing webinars, there's a whole bunch of, you know, tools out there for that you don't need to necessarily build a completely customized solution. You could sort of pick and choose, and let's use this and this out of the box, but oh, okay, this kind of thing that you need to do is really different, so let's talk about a custom solution potentially there.
Yeah, and some and then those things, sort of, and a lot of the small businesses must rely on those kinds of options because software is just a black hole of research and development that occasionally doesn't, it's not worth the investment for, unless you're at a certain level. Mm-hmm. There's two ways that the other options have gone. It's get a bunch of different small apps and tie them together with string and get like Toggle for your time tracking, Atlassian Suite for your project management, QuickBooks for your invoicing and accounting, and then tie them together with something like Zapier or IFTTT.
Yep.
Learn something about webhooks if you really want to, because then you need the marketing software, the website, the CRM, and before you know it, you have, like, we did a headcount early on at Omni, and we realized we have 25 applications that aren't even used to do the work.
Yeah.
They're just for maintaining a business. It's nuts. And then the other side of that is companies like Odoo have created a whole suite of applets that are all tied together, and they talk to each other really well. So there's one side that says all-in-one package, but you're going to have sacrifices, and the other side is have a specific tool for every job, but good luck tying them together. So that's a big barrier at the moment that I'm hoping someone figures out a little bit better, but there's so many different heads in the room that it gets a little bit out of control when you need something really specific.
Yeah, exactly. And
which
I just
is, which
recently
is where we come in.
Yeah, and I just recently I was playing with IFTTT for a while, the if this then that. And then I discovered Zapier. And I actually I love Zapier as a way of tying my stuff together, you know. So it's still like an if this then that, you know. If someone signs up for your newsletter, then you send them this set of emails or something like that. Someone signs up for my mm-hmm. course, then you send them that set of emails or whatever it is. My business is very email based.
And with those operations, it's pretty simple. But
yeah, but I can imagine when it's not a small business, when it's a bigger small business or even an actual big business, that then it goes more to, okay, the string that's tying this together may not be strong enough, and then we need to either pay more for a bigger solution, for a bigger software that's more comprehensive and bulkier and clunkier, or do something custom.
Yeah, and if you can imagine the conversation you would have with someone as they explain the different moving pieces for various areas of their business, I love having that conversation. That is one of my favorite things.
That's awesome.
And I get to do it on occasion at this point, but we've really focused more on working with agencies that have done a lot of that work. So solutions companies like Turnberry, who do a lot of technical solutions. Spark DSG is a fantastic user experience and user design shop, and the things that we get from them, the spec is so well refined that it requires very little of our own requirement elicitation after that point. It's very, very clean. So a lot of our partners end up being more on the, we're more downstream of them at this point, mm-hmm. which the pro there is more predictability. Con there is that you can charge less, you can't charge as much money, and you have to rely on these other vendors to do their job. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Besides the opportunity to work with some great partners and great vendors, you had mentioned you really love having these conversations with folks about tying all the pieces together. Why is it that you love those conversations so much?
That's kind of a multifaceted answer. I've been through it.
Yeah.
And I've always been the person, the tactician who actually ties these things together, ropes them all into one spot, and For running a software business and having so many moving pieces between clients, projects, hours, billable, and all of these other things, it gets a little convoluted. And that's one thing I've always been decent with, is where the data needs to go to certain spots. So building little applets to take care of these things. And the other reason I like it is it talking about those particular data flows of a business will tell you more about how a business operates, because despite the speed bumps to get these things hooked up, their operations are so tethered to the concept. You get a really good mental model because you get to see what doesn't fit the model. And mm-hmm. they have a model for how they're operating that is in conflict. And to understand the conflict, you have to understand the whole situation between what's out there and what they need. So mm-hmm. for me, it's been a great way to learn very quickly in a very practice manner. And and it's also just naturally interesting to me. I have no other explanation for that part.
No, I could totally relate to that. And I asked partially because I love the conversations that I have with potential clients and clients about sort of unearthing the truth, so to speak. So even though we're talking about almost vastly different things, you know, you're talking about software and applets and potentially building software, and I'm talking about helping tech managers with their leadership and helping them to build better teams. But mm-hmm. at the core of it, it's basically, okay, you come to me with this problem, but let me play detective and ask you some questions here and really dig down deep to reveal the truth of the matter. And what's awesome from my perspective, but also I feel it on the other end of the line too, is that, wow, you know, I never realized that. I came to you because I want help giving feedback to people, but I realized that I need to work on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 as well. So it sounds like you're saying a very similar thing where it's like, okay, I need help, you know, with this particular business process. But in asking questions, you get to get them to take a big picture look at their business and realize that there's a lot that may need fixing and that you can help with that.
Yeah, and the number of stakeholders you have to talk to increases exponentially with the complexity of the business. Mm-hmm. Very rarely one department can kind of give you all those answers. But
right.
for smaller businesses that want to do that whole slapping of things together, it seems to seems to be like one or two people to talk to about that. And usually you can break that down in the course of a couple of days. Other times it requires something stronger than coffee.
Right. Not even so a double espresso multiple times a day. I could see that. Hey there, folks. We'll get back to the interview in two shakes of a lamb's tail. But first, are you a tech manager? Is leading your team like herding cats? Are you sick of making stuff up without trusted systems to guide you? Are your days filled with useless, time-sucking meetings? Join my Facebook group with other tech geeks who are coming together to build thriving, high-performing teams who don't need constant hand-holding. No HR BS, just real stories from real geeks who understand the nuances of being a techie. To join us, go to genbunk.com/Facebook. Without further ado, please enjoy the remainder of the interview. So let's shift the conversation a little bit and let's talk about culture and culture fit. Because you had mentioned that one of the things that you're interested in are career searching tools that can help people to match their value sets to corporate culture. And I think there's a lot worth talking about there. So let's unpack this a little bit. And first, when you think of culture, or company culture, or corporate culture, what do you mean by that? What comes to mind?
I'm at such a disadvantage because I'm so far behind on the academic end of these things.
Yeah, don't worry about that. I don't want the academic stuff.
Yeah, I'm not going to give you a book. I'm not going to give you a book definition. I'm sure some scholar will yell at me for this. But the most salient features of the culture that I've been finding for a lot of the research I've been looking at is tied into like the immediate, not only the immediate environment that the person's working in, but the top-down driven message of the organization. Mm-hmm. The more I look at, I hate talking about my generation like this, the more I look at millennials and their interest in finding occupations that have a driven focus, a reason for it to exist, something that's more than just making money. There's this disconnect on occasion where the work that they're doing doesn't seem to be meaningful. And this picks off of like Teresa Mobley's work on the progress principle. You have to feel like you're moving forward in some way. Mm-hmm. And that's what a lot of people feel. So this kind of started me thinking down this road. And then I would meet other people that are entirely disinterested with this idea.
Yeah.
So there's an inherent motivation difference between different kinds of people. But overall, like an organization that supports and is very well aligned with its core objectives, it seems to be meaningful steps forward that still feel good. So it's a good mixture of feeling engaged, that something's actually moving forward, and that the culture is fitting values that you yourself have. So that shifted mm-hmm. more into thinking about the core objectives are driven towards the values, and the values are pretty, and most people, they might not be able to put a label on the values that they have, mm-hmm. And they're full of contradictions of those values when they eat at McDonald's, but don't like the idea of how pigs are kept or something. There's a misalignment. There's this cognitive dissonance about I'm doing these things that are in direct conflict with the things I believe in. So I started doing some analysis on ONET's database with the work values and work context, and finding that in most cases, a lot of the KSAOs that are involved with job fit are really well correlated between other industries. Like salespeople, the skills and abilities for a salesperson, this is like a retail salesperson, are highly correlated with the skills of an animal trainer.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So if I had an option between the two, and I wasn't worried about the other elements involved with this situation, obviously the work context changes.
Yeah.
Do people even know that these options are out there? Do they even know that they're really well fit for like this one occupation that has the better value set, more in line with what they're doing? The work context is it fits their frame of mind and what they want to be engaging with more often. And the only thing that's really shielding this from visibility is the fact that it has a very different job title in a completely different industry that they never would think of actually being a good fit for. So I want to bring this to light. I want to show people that these are out there. And I've been kicking around some different software ideas for doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Haven't really gotten down to brass tacks on it yet, but it's been rolling around my head a lot because of there's all these companies I'm working with that have these end goals and they have a certain culture to them. And I get to mm-hmm. feel that, see it, be part of it while I'm there. And I also work with a lot of people that are Eastern European. And the thought of entrepreneurism is so vastly different between the two.
Okay.
It's like stripped of a lot of individualism. And it's a very different value set, very different way of thinking. And there's a lot of pushing to get a more business savvy idea in their heads, and there's certain kinds of work contexts, certain kinds of value sets, things that I see with a hybrid model of our company possibly muddying the waters when it comes to a direction for the company. So
mm-hmm.
my attention is also on more international companies and how they preserve a culture across seas.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned ONET, and I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about how you've found it useful, and also just because it's been so long since I visited there myself, how to get there. Because I think, so not only like what it is, but also how people might use it to think about career planning, or if you're happy with your career, at least understanding the context around different careers. So essentially, what is ONET? How do you get there? But then also, how people might find it useful.
Sure. So I really hope some recruiters listen to this, because amazingly, I found that most staffing and recruiting firms never heard of ONET, which mm-hmm. is, coming from my background, mind-blowing, but I guess I wouldn't either unless I had a background education in it
yep.
with this kind of stuff. So ONET is a massive database of thousands of occupations ranging from software developers to farm workers, to construction, to industrial manufacturing, chemical, whatever it is. They keep up to date relatively with the newer trends, but those are a little bit less elegant, because the way that it's curated is industrial psychologists do job analysis using a set protocol of analysis of different jobs. So they go out, survey positions, and then they submit the results to what is effectively the Department of Labor's baby for this database. And over the years, it's accumulated this really rich and very robust set that on the database side, most people don't actually see. When you go to onetonline.org, you are presented with a ton of information about whatever job you want. The jobs in there are, and they're going to do an update on this next year, so the SOC codes are going to be different, but
mm-hmm.
the Department of Labor labels every single occupation with a certain ID number, and those are utilized in ONET to keep track of where this position sits in the long list of jobs that the Department of Labor recognizes. So mm-hmm. if you go there, you have a couple options. You can just search for a job or search for an occupation. It tells you what knowledge you need, what kind of skill sets you need, what kind of abilities, and these are all very well broken down, and they're ranked based on how important they are, the educational background, and then it has information that's not just about the person who takes this position, mm-hmm. but also about what the environment is. So it's effectively like a really long job description, what the work context is, what kinds of values there are, and values being like, do you want to be left alone or you want to be working with other people? Do you want confrontational environments where you're, say, negotiating lots of contracts with people, or do you want something where it's more solitary? Or how much data crunching and analytical stuff you want to do compared to just rote iterations of doing the same thing over and over again? Mm-hmm. So there's lots of things that you can go through that, and on occasion I've gone through and said, I'd like to do that. That looks cool. And that usually has related jobs to it and breakdowns for those as well. It also indicates what the outlook is, what the typical salary is. It could probably use a UI update. So if anyone from the Department of Labor is listening, we'd be happy to do a full-blown web development build out for a new front end for that site. It is not pretty, but it is incredibly informative, and the data behind it is freely available, so anyone can download it. It's just a SQL dump, just every table that they have available, and they have explanations for how the model works, how they curate the data, how it's all set up, and how you can use it. Yep. A lot of companies have actually used it, and I think US Jobs actually has like a find your career path model built on this data.
Okay.
I'm hoping to do more with it. I'm hoping to do a lot more using machine learning and maybe some artificial intelligence if I get to a certain level with it, to build out career paths, recommendations for recruiters, use this information that is so abundant.
Yeah, and the career path stuff, the having the map, you can't know where it's possible to go if you don't have a map in front of you. But if you have a map in front of you, you can say, oh, wow, there's an ocean there. And if I cross that ocean, I can go visit, you know, this country that I've never heard of. This can be, you know, this could be interesting. This could be exciting. And so I think if people think about their careers that way, both if you're early on in just sort of planning on what do I want to do when I grow up, but even if you're already quote unquote grown up and you're thinking about what's the next step in my career, like having those paths, like I work with tech managers, for example. Okay, what's the path from engineer to manager to director to CTO? Okay, I don't want to follow that path. What's a different option? And so having some mm-hmm. sort of software, some sort of something, right? Some sort of application to sort of help people think through that. And even if it just at a minimum shows people the options of here's what other people in your situation have done, you know, even if it's just here's a bunch of jobs that you might want to look up on Onet and see what they're like, and then you can make a decision from there. Mm-hmm. Of course, it could be more powerful than that. But I think even just that would be extremely helpful to people.
Especially to like high school counselors that are recommending mm-hmm. courses and schools to students. I remember my experience with that, along with many of my peers, was highly non-educational.
It's a nice way of putting it. Not well thought out
on anyone's part. And people take all these jobs, like all these surveys on what should I be when I grow up?
Yeah.
Well, how about we use this nice, well-refined database and give you your stretch goals? Like the problem that you get with this is you get some pretty lofty goals when you start going through this and start finding that, oh, I want to be a CTO. Mm-hmm. Well, when you're going to college, that's not a realistic goal at the moment. Like, that's a stretch goal. Like, what are the steps in between? Like, how do you get to that other country? Where do you buy your ticket? That's the kind of stuff where my issue with this is that it's not actionable the way that it's currently presented to people. If we make it more actionable, give them guidelines to where they can get the education required, the certifications for that particular occupation, ways to improve other skills and abilities, languages they should be learning and recommendations for those, schools that are highly rated for these certain things. And a lot of these focus on education, but other ones focus on, okay, what's a job that's similar, that's I am qualified for, mm-hmm. and I have a good culture fit for this kind of work. Because mm-hmm. I've noticed that depending on who you're talking to every day, and this goes back to supervisor satisfaction being highly related to employee engagement, if you're interacting with certain people that are sore spots in the culture, that's a very biased environment to be in compared to the rest of the organization that might be more open. In the microcosm that you're in usually has a big effect because it's what you experience every day. Mm-hmm. And then anything that's more in line with the real corporate goals looks like hypocritical memos.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a step back and talk a little bit about your training, which just happens to be my training in IO psychology. One thing that I like to ask my IO psych friends that I'm going to ask you right now, which is, has your training in IO psychology, do you feel that it's helped or hindered your ability in your current role and your current job?
I think that it's helped a lot with various things that I've worked on. It's brought a lot of cognitive closure to things that I would otherwise just continue to view as in a amorphous mess of people. and that's something that I definitely attribute to the direction that my degree drifted me towards. I think that looking into like my education and what I did learn compared to what would help me more is, this goes back to a lot of programs in IO psychology that try to bridge the academic practitioner gap. Mm-hmm. But instead of doing a high level, like highly rigorous program between the two of them, yep. they occasionally dumb down the academic stuff so the people that want to focus on practice can focus on practice, and they give a little sprinkling of practice to the academics who want to focus on academic stuff. They get a little sprinkling of practice, but not to a high enough level to be actionable. Mm-hmm. So, I can see if you're going to treat this as two separate things, you've already lost. It's like talking about race. So if we mm-hmm. stop treating academic and practitioner as separate things, yeah. and instead focus on, hey, this is the real world, here's the best academic resources to build a case for these things. And it was more, more practical in nature, in practical being different from just practice, because everything about IO psychology, the purpose for IO psychology is very different than the purpose for cognitive psychology or social psychology as a science. It's mm-hmm. it's driven towards a purpose. Yeah. And focusing on that is really, really important for anyone who's coming out with that degree, unless you want to teach it. But if you want to teach it, drive it towards what the paradigm of that education ought to be.
Mm-hmm. And I think...
And that's my personal opinion on that, so...
Yeah. And I think what I hear you saying, just sort of adding on my own experiences and own thoughts about this, is that, like, don't... the what you had mentioned about, like, if you try to do it all, you can't... If you're trying to do everything, you're basically going to just dilute it out and not serve anybody, right? So let's be true to what this is that, yes, there is science here, there is research here, but that research feeds the practice, and it's a cycle. And so let's not ignore one piece of the cycle. Let's not, like, give one piece of the cycle not enough attention, because we need to understand that, like, yes, there is, you know, for example, research out there that can help us, and that shows us that there are certain better ways to, say, hire people and to decide who to hire. But we also need to realize the the realities of the hiring process, and that not every company, for example, is going to have all of the data or all of the resources in order to do a full-blown validation study, which is essentially what the science says we should do, right? So we need to kind of meet in the middle.
Hate to break that.
Yeah. So how do we meet in the middle to say, okay, here's the stuff. This is the gold standard. Yeah, I get that this is what we should be doing, and then this is what works. And if I'm a multi-billion-dollar company, yeah, absolutely, I can do it. But what if I'm a company with 100 or 200 employers and we employees, and we don't hire that much, how can we take some of the tidbits, some of the juicy stuff from the research and apply it in practice? And then let's apply it in practice. And then let's use that to then inform future research. So I think that's sort of like looking at it that way, I think, is a way of sort of melding the two worlds together.
Yeah, and I hate to break it to anyone, but the databases for human resource information systems and applicant tracking systems, they're a mess. They're a complete and total mess, especially the larger the organization is. Mm-hmm. Someone probably set it up very, very well and then exited, and then someone came in who's equally intelligent and tried just as hard, but would do it slightly different. And when you do that to a normalized database and you start tweaking and changing and adding and not quite reinforcing all the time the most best practices, it becomes a huge issue. Secondly, the business owners usually look at HR as an expense. This is a cost to the business. This is part of my overhead, less so of an investment. And that changes a lot depending on the organization you talk to. But when you're not prospecting companies like Google, you have to get over that barrier and explain very, very concrete terms what the return on investment for these things are. And even then, they're focused on the easiest thing that there is to drive revenue, which is the marketing and sales funnel. The closer that company is to, say, an IPO, the more they're going to care a lot more about that cash flow that investors are looking for and stakeholders are looking for.
Yeah, unfortunately, for startups or even not so startups, the last thing that they're thinking about is hiring an HR person. And if they hire an HR person, it's usually just one person, and then they're not thinking about growing the HR or people operations department or whatever it is. When I see the success stories of companies in Boston, but you know, around the country and around the world, who were startups but then ended up being really awesome companies, were the ones who invested in the quote-unquote human resources, people operations side of things. And even though they may only have 200 or 300 or 500 employees, they have a team of HR folks. It's not just one HR person who has to wear all of the hats and just basically ends up being the person that you go to when it's time to ask about benefits, right? And that person just ends up being a babysitter for everybody. That no, you need people who are working on training, who are working on hiring, who are working on recruiting, working with the recruiters, working with everyone. And so, yeah, it is sad. You know, there's the sad stories that like, oh, you know, you really should have invested more in your people. But there's also those success stories out there that we can look to. You know, if you look at any of the like the best company to work for lists, and you look for any of the commonalities among those companies, I guarantee you that 90-95% of those companies are investing in human resources and building that. And they don't just see it as an expense; they see it as an investment, and that's how they're going to do better.
Yeah, and on a more organizational level, the most successful ones are also adopting some principles from an agile methodology where they organize the workflow as far as people dynamics go in a way that frankly just disarms managers entirely. Like just kind of rips that entire thought of, oh, you can make decisions and you can't, and boils it down to just people that act as scrum masters in a way, just asking, hey, what are your blockers? How can I clear those for you? And they don't, Google doesn't let their managers make direct hires. They're not allowed. It's out of the question. They submit a request and that's handled internally. Yep. So there's certain kinds of ways to not only treat in a traditional sense for it, who's the right person for this job? What should I be paying people? How can I get my people more motivated, more energized? There's more proactive organizational tweaking that can be done as far as job engineering and workflow processes and giving people meaningful things to do. So there's a lot, is highly multifaceted, and it's never organized, and it's always going to be different for every single company all the time.
Right, because context matters. Yeah, but I mean, but you're bringing up Agile, I think that's great because it's an engineering process. So let's look at it from if you're an engineering company, if you're a tech company, fine, look at this from an engineering perspective, from a tech perspective. You're using Agile for your software development, right? Okay, why don't you apply the same principles to your people development as well? And that could be I found that's sort of like a nice in terms of getting people to think that way because they're already thinking that way when they're talking about building their software and building their tools.
Yeah, and an incidental part of that, which I think falls in by accident, software development is necessarily non-predictive. The more a company tries to develop software in a waterfall method where it's like get the spec down perfect, absolutely perfect all the time at the very beginning, it doesn't happen that way. Mm-hmm. There's so many failure points along the way, and there's so many things that can be learned, and the variables in play for that involves the people and the technology. And the technology is never predictable, and the people are never predictable. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that has carried over, and it works well if you keep the metaphor going for people dynamics. If you have to remove the whole thought of cost from the equation entirely and focus on the general roadmap moving forward and an iterative process and things like that. So the more immediate people can get feedback on how they're doing, the better. And that's one thing that Agile brings to the table.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so last question for you, Spencer. This is a question that I ask everyone who I interview, so I'm interested in your take on this, your response. The question is, what is the biggest people-related challenge in your job?
Because there's a couple that come to mind. I'm trying to think of what's the most troublesome one. The most troublesome one that we come across is expectation setting in very traditional industries. There are a lot of people who don't quite understand software, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. Totally understandable. We can talk as long as possible about what to expect from a project. But a huge barrier is that it is such a vastly different model of thinking from traditional investments and it doesn't match any allegories, any metaphorical sense about like, oh, it's like engineering. No, it's not. It's more like an iceberg. You never know what's underneath it. Mm-hmm. So for me, the biggest challenge when it comes to people in this is having a mutual understanding of requirements and expectations when there are so many nuanced tiny little things that are just impossible to build assumptions around. So that's probably the biggest challenge I face is getting the point driven home that this is not going to be like building a house. It's not going to be like even building a bridge. It's going to be non-predictive, and that's just an uncomfortable part of everyone's methodology for having a business is you have to know what return to expect on this investment, and we can't even tell you what the investment is going to be. So that bridge and explaining that to anyone who hasn't managed a software project is a foreign concept, and that communication point, that's a very difficult and critical point to drive home.
Mm-hmm. And I think the earlier in the conversation that you bring that up and make sure that they understand that, the better that it goes later. They still need reminders along the way that, stuff is going to blow up, right? Stuff is going to go wrong. And it's not necessarily because we did anything wrong or that you did anything wrong or that we didn't communicate, just because stuff happens and it's unpredictable, right? I like this isn't like building a bridge or building a house metaphor, because you're often building something that you don't know what it's, you have some sense of what you want it to look like in the end, but because it's an iterative process, because it's a process that unfolds over time, because it's, oh, okay, this is great, this is version one, but what's version two going to look like? This sort of going into mm-hmm. that with sort of playful mindset that like, this is what I want, but I'm going to realize that there's going to be bumps on the road, and let's at least have a little bit of fun along the way going over those bumps. And that's been a hard thing for me to sort of get over and realize. Just using the example of websites, one of the things that I was told one time that really helped me in thinking about when I'm hiring someone or working with someone to build a website for, build a page for me or work on my website, is that it's never done. That you, especially in the beginning, it's basically like, okay, I want this website. And I was like, no, don't think about it that way. Right? This is going to be version one. Let's get it out there. Let's get it let's get it out to the world, and then we're going to find out what's broken, and then we'll fix it. And then your needs are going to change. Your clients' needs are going to change. And so with that, the software or the website can change along with it. And so I think that I can relate to that. I've been on both sides of that, and that dealing with expectations is very can be very tricky, a very tricky tightrope to walk.
Yeah, and the better that the person on the ground on the battlefield can understand what's really going on, and be empowered to make certain decisions at that level, the more committed they'll be. And you might not get exactly what you want in your head, but when you see what comes out of it, you'll realize that, okay, it's meeting the goal that needs to meet. Mm-hmm. That's the requirement, and that's such a difficult thing to get explained down the chain. It doesn't really matter how well defined it is from manager's perspective. It doesn't matter how well the project manager understands it, or the product owner, or the client even. It doesn't matter how well that's synced up right there. Yeah. If the people actually doing the work aren't part of that conversation, then something's gonna get missed. There's always something, and the lack of highly thorough documentation means that you're gonna have increased risk of that unless you have them in all the calls, which is why daily calls are great. And it's kind of like the issues that come up in this are breaks in the system, are things that no one would catch unless they're caught really early, or if they are caught later, it would be a huge expense. Yep. And of course, that part is analogous to like the Toyota method. So in a certain way, we can build a parallel to building cars, but I can't tell you how much time, how much money you're going to spend if it takes a developer a certain amount of time to change something. It's not like if there's an issue on the line and someone has to put a bolt back on, there's a certain cost associated with that you can kind of calculate.
Yep. I do have one more question for you, Spencer, that I just thought of based on this conversation about managing expectations and, you know, the product team working with the project managers, working with the developers and the managers, that I realize that I'm curious what your response is to this, and what insight you might have. If you could give one or two pieces of advice to either the software developers themselves, you know, so the software engineers themselves, or the managers of those folks, so that this whole process, all of this stuff, that the software development process goes better, what would be those one or two pieces of advice?
Never hesitate to look stupid. uh-huh. Is one. When they say there's no such thing as a dumb question, there really isn't. Even if it's something that like you should have known since day one, something that you just like dozed out in the middle of a call on and you just didn't catch, ask it, because if you don't, it's going to bite everyone very hard, very fast.
Yeah.
So that's one, and I think the other is don't be afraid to come up with ideas for things. There's a sense among people in certain roles that they have blinders on the side of their eyes, that they need to focus solely on getting this done, executing it well, and that's it. But a lot of the times, I've had project managers get really great ideas and options from developers who understand this better, and they speak up and they recommend certain tweaks. And I've also had project managers who talk to developers and basically pull their heads out of the weeds 2 feet and say, hey, look, you have these other options right here that you haven't considered. Pull back, focus. And there's a lot of literally collaborative nature behind that. I think encouraging that benefits the product in the long run, because you get the right sources of information from different people without hesitation and without shame.
And I think on that note, that's a great note to end on. Thank you so much, Spencer. That's Spencer Verity, folks. He's the director of product at Speed and Function.
Thanks, Jen. Appreciate you having me on.
Okay.